Welcome to One Mic. I'm your host, Country Boy, and today's episode is about Henrietta Lacks and her immortal cells. In 1951, Henrietta Lacks was diagnosed with terminal cervical cancer while being treated at Johns Hopkins University, where a doctor named George Gay removed her cells from her cervix without informing her. Later, Gay discovered that her cells could not only be kept alive, but would grow indefinitely. For the last 60 years, Henrietta cells have been cultured and used in experiments ranging from determining the long-term effects of radiation to testing the polio vaccine. Her cells have been commercialized and have generated millions of dollars in profit for medical researchers. If this is the sort of content that you like, please hit the subscribe button. Also, you can find more content like this on onemichistory.com, but without further ado, let's get started. Henrietta Lacks was born Loretta Pleasant on August 1st, 1920 in Roanoke, Virginia to Eliza Pleasant and Johnny Randall Pleasant. Her family was not sure how her name became changed from Loretta to Henrietta, but her nickname was apparently Henny. When Henrietta was 4 years old in 1924, her mother died giving birth to her 10th child, and her father was unable to care for all of those children alone, so Johnny Pleasant moved his family to Clover, Virginia, where the children were divided up amongst the relatives. Henrietta ended up staying with her paternal grandfather, Tommy Henry Lacks, in a two-story, four-room cabin. She shared a room with her 9-year-old first cousin, David Day Lacks. Like most family members living in Clover, Virginia, Henrietta worked as a tobacco farmer from a very early age. She woke up each morning at 4 o'clock in the morning to feed the animals, to tend the garden, and to toil the tobacco fields. She spent much of her young life in those same fields. She would also attend a designated black school up until the 6th grade, where she would have to drop out to help support her family in the tobacco fields. In 1935, when Henrietta was only 14 years old, she gave birth to her first child, a son, Lawrence Lacks. In 1939, she would give birth to her second child, a daughter, Elsie Lacks, and both children were fathered by her cousin, David Day Lacks. In April 10th of 1941, David Lacks and Henrietta Lacks were married in Halifax County, Virginia. Near the end of 1941, their cousin Fred Garrett would travel back to Clover, Virginia from Baltimore to visit his family in his brand new 36 Chevy with his brand new clothes. He would convince the couple to leave Virginia and move to Turner Station because only a year earlier, Fred and his brother Cliff had been tobacco farmers in those very same fields as Henrietta and Day. The very next day, Fred would buy Day a ticket to Baltimore, and they agreed that Henrietta would stay behind with the children until Day made enough money for a place for them in Baltimore. But only a few months later, Fred would get drafted and shipped off to fight in World War II. But before he left, Fred gave Day all the money that he had been saving, telling him that it was time for Henrietta and the children to come to Turner Station. With the savings gifted by Garrett, David Lacks was able to purchase a home. So Henrietta, with each child by her side, would board the first train for Turner Station. While living in Maryland, Henrietta and Day would have 3 more children. David Sonny Lacks in 1947, Deborah Lacks in 1949, and Joseph Lacks in 1950. On January 29, 1951, Henrietta would go to Johns Hopkins because it was the only hospital in the area that treated black patients, complaining of a knot that she felt within her womb. She had previously told her cousins about the same knot, and they had assumed it was because she was pregnant with Joseph. But after giving birth, Henrietta had a severe hemorrhage. Her primary care doctor had tested her for syphilis, but it came back negative. So he referred her back to Johns Hopkins. There, a doctor by the name of Howard W. Jones would do a biopsy of a mass found on Henrietta's cervix for laboratory testing. Soon after, Lax was told that she had a malignant epidermoid carcinoma on her cervix. The treatment for cancer at the time was radium. When radium was first discovered in the late 1800s, it was hailed as a substitute for electricity and a cure for every single disease. Doctors would administer it in powder form for everything from treating seasickness to ear infection. The thing is that radium destroys any cell that it encounters, and patients who had taken it for trivial issues would begin dying. While radium kills cancer cells, radium also causes mutations that can turn into cancer. During her treatments, Henrietta would lie unconscious on a operating table with her feet up in stirrups, and a surgeon on duty, a Dr. Lawrence Wharton Jr., prepared to treat her tumor. She had no knowledge, and no one had asked Henrietta's permission for Dr. Wesley Tindall to take samples from her cervix. Two samples would be taken, one of healthy cervical tissue and the other of the cancer. These samples would be given to George Otto Gay, a physician and cancer researcher at Johns Hopkins. See, at the time, there was always a need for a steady supply of sample cells because they kept dying. There were a lot of obstacles to growing cells, and no one knew exactly what nutrients they need to survive and how much to supply them. Researchers would try for many years to develop the perfect culture medium, which is the liquid that feeds the cells. The recipe for a culture medium would constantly evolved as they searched for that perfect balance. And the ingredients were not easy to come by. They had ingredients like the plasma from chickens, pureed calf fetus, special salts, the blood from a human umbilical cord, and that wasn't even the toughest challenge facing a cell culture. The biggest issue was contamination. Bacteria and other microorganisms would find their way into cultures from unwashed hands, from breath, or from other dust particles floating through the air and would contaminate and destroy the samples. All of these issues would need to be resolved before they could ever do anything to Henrietta's sample. When the lab did get around to testing Henrietta's sample, they would slice off a small 1 millimeter square, drop them into a test tube with a culture medium, and plug it with a rubber stopper. The lab would normally label each culture with the patient's first and last name, but for Henrietta Lax, they would simply write Gila. While other samples suffered, Henrietta's cancer cells grew insanely fast. They doubled almost overnight. Her cells would grow, doubling in numbers almost every 24 hours, dividing multiple times without dying. And this is how her cells came to be known as immortal. So George Gay felt that the key to conquering cancer lay within Henrietta's cancer cells. He felt that if he could study her cells, he would be able to locate a way to damage or completely wipe out cancer. To assist this, Gay would send HeLa cells to any scientist who could use them for cancer research. What made Henrietta cells so amazing for cancer research is that it allows scientists to perform experiments that would be impossible with live human beings. Researchers were able to expose HeLa cells to toxins, radiations, infections. They would even inject them with drugs and study their immune suppression and cancer growth in immune-compromised rats. If the cells died in the process, it cost the scientists nothing. They could just go back to their immortal HeLa cells and start the process all over again. Despite all of this revolutionary research and HeLa cells spreading all over the globe, no one spoke about this revolutionary HeLa line or how it could help cure cancer. So the general public had no idea of Henrietta or her cancer cells. Meanwhile, Henrietta herself had other issues other than recognition for her cells. In June of 1951, she complained to doctors that she thought the cancer was spreading and that she could feel it moving. Her doctors insisted that she was fine and even wrote in her chart, "Patient states that she feels fairly well and no evidence of a reoccurrence," and told her to come back within a month. During this time, there was a practice called benevolent deception. This was the process in which doctors intentionally misled patients to prevent a possible negative effect from the disclosure of their actual diagnosis, and patients simply wouldn't question it. It was especially true for Black patients in 1951 and questioning the judgment of a white doctor or a white person in general. Just 2 weeks later, Henrietta was back at Johns Hopkins explaining about abdomen pain, and it was almost impossible for her to urinate. X-rays showed that she had a large stony mass that filled her abdomen. Doctors now stated that her outlook looked quite poor and the tumors were inoperable. Each day they would increase her dose of radiation to help ease her pain and the size of the tumors, but the pain just kept getting worse and the tumors kept getting larger. The doctors would attempt to ease her suffering with analgesic drugs. New tumors would appear in her body almost daily. And in September 1951, Henrietta's body was almost completely taken over by tumors. And the doctors injected her with a heavy dose of morphine and wrote in her chart to discontinue all medications and treatment outside of painkillers. In October 4th, 1951, at 12:15 a.m., Henrietta Lacks passed away. And researchers wasted absolutely no time. They wanted as many samples of Henrietta as possible, but to get new samples after her death would require the permission of her family. See, the law was very clear about performing an autopsy or removing tissue from the dead without permission was extremely illegal, but there was no such provision requiring doctors to do the same for living patients. So when Henrietta's husband stopped by Johns Hopkins to see her body, the doctors would ask them about an autopsy. They would frame it to him, this might help his children someday. And without knowing their actual intentions, he gave them consent and signed the autopsy permission form. The autopsy would show that cancer had metastasized over her entire body. After the autopsy, Henrietta would be buried in an unmarked grave at her family's cemetery in a place called Laxtown in Halifax County, Virginia. Also in 1951, polio was an epidemic. The public was getting desperate for a vaccine. So in 1952, a man by the name of Jonas Sachs from the University of Pittsburgh announced that he had developed the world's first polio vaccine, but he was unable to offer it to children until it could be tested on a mass scale. Researchers required millions of neutralization tests, which was a mix of mixing a blood serum from vaccinated children with the live polio virus and cells in a culture. If the vaccine worked, the serum from vaccinated children would block the virus. The problem was that the cells used in the culture came from live monkeys, and creating the neutralization test would kill the monkeys. And the monkeys were extremely expensive. So this caused researchers to look for cheaper ways to acquire cultured cells. This is where HeLa cells became so important because they grew like no other human cells that researchers had ever seen. So when researchers found out that HeLa cells were susceptible to the polio virus and could be grown in enormous quantities for extremely little money, they developed the first HeLa distribution center at Tuskegee University. The HeLa distribution center allowed for 35 Tuskegee scientists to produce over 6 trillion cells a week. Originally, the Tuskegee Center would only supply HeLa cells for polio testing labs, but soon they were offering up to any scientist that was interested in purchasing them. Despite being cancerous, HeLa cells share some basic characteristics of normal cells. They produce protein, they communicated with one another like normal cells, they divided, they generated energy, and more importantly, they were susceptible to infections, which made them an optimal tool for synthesizing and studying bacteria, hormones, proteins, and especially viruses. Henrietta cells helped launch the fledgling field of virology. Researchers would expose HeLa cells to viruses to study how each one entered a cell, reproduced, and spread. Much, much later, HeLa cells would still be used to study the COVID-19 virus. As the Cold War escalated, some scientists even exposed Henrietta cells to a massive dose of radiation to study how nuclear bombs destroyed cells, find possible ways to reverse that damage. Others would expose HeLa cells to centrifuges where the pressure was more than 100,000 times the force of gravity, just to see what would happen to human cells under extreme conditions like deep sea diving or spaceflight. Cosmetic companies and pharmaceutical companies would also use HeLa cells instead of laboratory animals to test products and drugs and see if they cause cellular damage. And the U.S. government would use HeLa cells to study hemorrhagic fever, which was killing American troops. In 1954, HeLa cells would begin to be used for some less than ethical experiments. A man by the name of Chester M. Southam, a leading virologist, began to inject HeLa cells into cancer patients because at the time, he believed that cancer was caused by either a virus or immune system deficiency. Within hours of injecting the patient's arms were red and swollen. Days later, they would have cancerous nodules near the injection site. Southam would remove some to verify they were in fact cancerous, but left others to see if the immune system would attempt to reject them or if the cancer would spread. Some patients, the tumors would vanish on their own within a few weeks, but four patients, the nodules grew back over and over again. Soon, Southam wanted to see how healthy patients would react to these same injections. So in 1956, he placed an ad in the Ohio State Penitentiary newsletter, and soon he had over 150 volunteers and began injecting prisoners with the cancerous HeLa cells. And what he found is that healthy subjects would fight off the cancer even after multiple injections. Southam was hailed in the press for his breakthrough in cancer research that could someday lead to a cancer vaccine. See, it wasn't until 1957 that the term informed consent would first appear in the United States court system after a patient had went under anesthesia and woke up permanently paralyzed. He would complain that doctors had not explained all the risks of the procedure to him. At this time, though, informed consent was focused squarely on doctors, and it made little mention of researchers. It wouldn't be for decades that someone would ask if informed consent should apply to Henrietta and her HeLa cells. Meanwhile, the patients of Southam's research would begin contacting researchers after they read about the informed consent lawsuit in the newspapers, and an investigation would be launched into his misconduct. This investigation would result in Southam losing his license for over a year and drastically change the oversight over experimentation of human beings. In the early 1970s, HeLa cells had been causing issues by contaminating a large portion of other cell cultures. As a result, members of Henrietta's family began receiving solicitations for blood samples from researchers hoping to gain access to their DNA of Henrietta's children so they could differentiate between HeLa cells and the other cell lines. Several family members began questioning why they were receiving telephone calls with requests for blood samples, and they were simply told that Henrietta cells were being used for the polio vaccine and genetic research. It wouldn't be until 1975 when the family had a conversation with a reporter from Rolling Stone about Henrietta Lacks and her continued use in medical research. At the time, the family had not discussed Henrietta's illness or the death among themselves, so they began bombarding the reporter with questions about her immortality, their mother's cells, and what any of this actually meant. At first, the family didn't seem overly concerned with the existence of her cells, but after they began reading the Rolling Stone article and found out that researchers could possibly be profiting from HeLa cells, they became convinced that researchers at Johns Hopkins had made millions off their mother's cells. The thing is Gay wasn't particularly interested in profiting from his science. As early as the 1940s, he had repeatedly turned down requests to run the first commercial cell culture lab. Various spokespeople from Johns Hopkins have issued statements stating that Johns Hopkins has never made a cent off of HeLa cells and that George Gay gave all of them away for free. Although no record of Johns Hopkins or Gay accepting money for HeLa cells, many biotech companies have, and there's no way of knowing how much revenue they have generated from Henrietta's cells. In March of 1976, when the Rolling Stone article actually hit newsstands, it was the first time that the full story of Henrietta Lacks had been told and the first time the mainstream media had reported on the woman behind HeLa cells and the fact that she was an African-American woman. The timing couldn't be worse. The news of the Tuskegee experiment was still fresh in the public's mind, having only broken in 1972, and the racial aspect behind HeLa cells was impossible to ignore. Henrietta was a poor black woman who was used as a tool, had her cells stolen from her by white scientists without her consent, and that was huge news. To understand the legal challenges that faced Henrietta's family in gaining control over her HeLa cells, you need to understand the cases of John Moore and Ananaim Chakrabarty. In 1976, John Moore was working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week as a surveyor for the Alaskan Pipeline, and he thought his job was literally killing him. Gums hurt, his belly swelled, and he had bruises all over his body. It turned out that he had hairy cell leukemia, a rare, deadly form of cancer that filled his spleen with malignant blood cells. Moore's local doctor referred him to a doctor by the name of David Gold, a prominent cancer researcher, and David Gold would remove his cancerous spleen. But after surgery, Moore would go on with his life. But every few months, he would have to fly back to Los Angeles from around 1976 to 1983 to have follow-up exams with Dr. Gold. At first, Moore didn't think much of these trips, but after years of flying from Seattle to LA, he asked why a doctor in Seattle couldn't do this. And Gold simply offered to pay for his plane tickets and put him up in a nice hotel. Moore wasn't initially suspicious. He did think this was odd, but that all changed one day in 1983 when he was given a new consent form. The consent form simply stated that the University of California had all the rights to his cell lines and any other product that could be developed from his blood or his bone marrow. This caused him to ask Gold if his cells had any commercial value, and he was told that they did not. But just in case, he decided that he would not consent to the form. Gold would send him call after call and letter after letter asking him to fix his accident on his consent form. This caused Moore to speak to a lawyer who found out that Gold had dedicated much of the 7 years since Moore's initial surgery developing and marketing a cell line simply called Mo. In the weeks before giving Moore this new consent form, Gold had filed a patent on Moore's cells and the valuable proteins that these cells produced. Gold hadn't yet sold the rights to the patent, but according to the lawsuit that Moore eventually filed, Gold had entered into an agreement with a biotechnical company that gave him stocks and financing worth almost $3.5 million to commercially develop and scientifically investigate this Moe cell line. It was at this point that the cell line was estimated at a value of almost $3 billion. And only years before the Moore lawsuit, nothing biological was considered patentable. But in 1980, when the Supreme Court ruled in the case of Anana M. Chakrabarty, a scientist who had worked with General Electric, who had helped create a genetically engineered bacteria that could consume oil and help clean up oil spills. When he filed a patent, he was denied on grounds that no living organism could be considered an invention. Chakrabarty's lawyers argued that normal bacteria didn't consume oil, and Chakrabarty's bacteria wasn't naturally occurring and only existed because of his own human ingenuity. Chakrabarty's victory opened up the possibility to patenting other living things, including modified animals and cell lines, as long as they weren't naturally occurring outside of the body. And as a bonus, these patent cell lines didn't require informed consent from the cell donors. Scientists were quick to point out that Moore's cell line was exceptional. Very few cell lines were actually worth patenting. Moore's cells produced a very rare protein that pharmaceutical companies could use to treat infections and even cancer. They also carried a rare virus called the HTLV virus, which was a distant cousin of HIV, which researchers hope could create a vaccine and stop the AIDS epidemic. Because of this, drug companies were willing to pay enormous sums of money to use his cells. In 1984, Moore was sued Gold and the University of UCLA for deceiving him and using his body for research without his consent. He also claimed the property rights over his tissue and sued Gold for stealing them. With that, he became the first person to make a legal claim on his own tissue and sue for profits and damages. Ultimately, the judge would throw out his lawsuit out of court, stating that he did not have a case. And ironically, though, he would cite the HeLa cell line as a precedent for what ultimately happened with the Moe cell line. He cited that the fact that no one from the Henrietta Lacks family sued over the growth and ownership of the HeLa cell line as proof that patients didn't mind doctors taking their cells and using them for commercial products. The judge believed that Moore was the rare objector when, in fact, he simply was the first to realize that something potentially objectionable was happening and that his sales had monetary value. Moore would appeal, and in 1988, the California Court of Appeals would rule in his favor, pointing out the Protection of Human Subjects in Medical Experiments Act of 1978. California statutes require research on humans respect the rights of individuals to determine what is done to their own body. The judge wrote that a patient must have the ultimate power to control what becomes of his or her tissue. To hold otherwise would open a door for a massive invasion of privacy and dignity in the name of medical progress. 7 years after Moore filed his original lawsuit, the Supreme Court of California ruled against Moore and issued a definitive statement on the issue. When tissues are removed from your body with or without your consent, any claim that you might have to ownership vanishes. When these tissues leave the doctor's office into a lab, you abandon them as waste, and anyone can take your garbage and then sell it. Since Moore had abandoned his cells, they were no longer a product of his body, and they had been transformed into an invention where they are now the product of Gold's human ingenuity. Moore was not awarded any profits from the Moe cell line, but a judge did agree with him on two counts. The lack of informed consent, because Gold had not disclosed his financial interests and breached his fiduciary duty, meaning that Gold had taken advantage of his position as a doctor doctor to violate his patient's trust. The doctor also said that researchers should disclose their financial interests in patients' tissues. Although no law required it, he also pointed out the lack of regulations and patient protections in tissue research and called on legislatures to remedy this issue. But he said that ruling in Moore's favor would destroy the economic incentive to conduct important medical research, and that giving patients property rights over their tissues might hinder and restrict access to necessary raw materials in a field where every cell sample a researcher purchases might be a potential lottery ticket. Despite the widespread media coverage of Moore's lawsuit, the Lacks family had no idea any of this was happening. As the debate over the ownership of human tissue played out all over the country, the Lacks family continued to tell anyone who could possibly listen that John Hopkins had stolen their mother's cells and owed them $1 million. Had the Lacks family had spoken to a lawyer might have explained to them they could sue for a privacy violation or the lack of informed consent. But over the next several decades, the family had limited success gaining control of the HeLa cells. The story of Henrietta Lacks would eventually catch the attention of BBC producer Adam Curtis, and in 1998, he would begin making a documentary on Henrietta and her HeLa cells, causing the case to gain a brand new visibility. In 2010, Rebecca Skloot would write the popular book on the subject called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Also in 2010, John Hopkins would release a statement concerning the cervical samples that they had taken from Henrietta without her consent. John Hopkins Medical Center sincerely acknowledges the contribution to the advances in biomedical researches made by Henrietta and her HeLa cells. It is important to note that at the time the cells were taken from Ms. Lacks, that the practice of obtaining informed consent from cell or tissue donors was essentially unknown among academic medical centers. 60 years ago, there was no established practice for seeking permission to take tissue for scientific research, and the laboratory received Ms. Lacks cells had arranged many years earlier to obtain cells from any patient diagnosed with cervical cancer as a way to learn more about the serious disease that took the lives of so many. John Hopkins never patented HeLa cells, nor did they sell them, commercially benefit them in any direct way. Today, John Hopkins and other research-based medical centers consistently obtain consent from those asked to donate tissues or cells for medical research. In 2013, researchers published the DNA sequence of the genome of a strain of HeLa cells. The Lacks family only discovered this because the author, Rebecca Skloot, informed them of this. There were some objections from the Lacks family about the genetic information that was made available for public access. They wanted to know what information was actually going to be available about Henrietta and what information they obtained from sequencing her DNA and what it would tell them about her children and her grandchildren. In August of 2013, an agreement was announced between the family and researchers that gave the family some control over access to the cell's DNA sequence, with a promise of acknowledgement for Henrietta in scientific papers. Recently, in 2021, Henrietta's family filed a federal lawsuit against Thermo Fisher Scientific, claiming unjust enrichment and unconsensual use of her cells and tissue samples. Thermo Scientific's business is to commercialize Henrietta Lacks' cells and her living body tissue without consent or to provide compensation to Ms. Lacks or her family. The lawsuit is asking the court to order Thermo Fisher Scientific to pay the full amount of its net profits obtained by commercializing the HeLa cell line to the estate of Henrietta Lacks. While Henrietta Lacks' HeLa cell lines are the first immortal cell line of human cells and have been reproduced trillions and trillions of times for medical research and have allowed for the development of an HPV vaccine, a polio vaccine, drugs for HIV and AIDS, leukemia, the Parkinson's disease, and even used to study COVID-19, but The injustice done to Henrietta and her family has caused an immeasurable amount of profit for biotech companies while giving her little recognition and offering no compensation to her family. Henrietta's story is just one in a long history of modern medicine thriving off the dehumanization of African Americans. Thank you. This has been One Mic. I'm your host, Country Boy. If you like stories like this, please hit the subscribe button. Also, you can find more stories like this on my channel and at onemichistory.com. And peace.